Hello there. Today is Friday, September 29th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a dire situation continues as the U.S. government steps up relief efforts in Puerto Rico.
The supply chain, the logistical chain in Puerto Rico is broken. It's not just broken, it is shattered. It is non-existent at this point.
Why hearing less about the Russia investigation may mean things are heating up.
This is a critical moment.
What Twitter and Facebook are saying about Russia's use of their platforms for propaganda, and what's new at the movies. It's all on today's International Edition. That's the sound of happy residents as various agencies, some from the federal government, pass out supplies to people struggling in Puerto Rico. The Trump administration has been criticized for not responding more quickly to the crisis in the U.S. territory, which was slammed by Hurricane Maria on September 17th. On Thursday, Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert defended the eight-day period between the declaration of an emergency in Puerto Rico and the naming of a military leader for recovery efforts.
People seeing 24 and 48-hour horizon problems where they're saying, I don't see enough food and water coming. It's my sincere belief that that food and water is going to get to them before that deadline arises, and then we're going to save their lives. I have no doubt in it. We've got over 10,000 people there now, and there's more on their way, including a lot of aerial support, USS Comfort. I'm going to read the numbers here for you. There's 12 Coast Guard cutters, 3 United States Navy ships, 1 DOT Maritime Administration vessel, 6 commercial ships with supplies en route, 7 additional ships to house responders, and we've got commodities distribution now exceeding millions, so 1.3 million meals, 2.7 million liters, that type of thing of water. So that's moving in today, and you're seeing the distribution problem unclog.
Officials acknowledged, however, that huge challenges still exist in aid delivery and in heading off a public health crisis. Thousands of 20 food containers of life-saving food and water that arrived in recent days are stacked up on docks in the port of San Juan, waiting for distribution. Florida Senator Marco Rubio says a shortage of truck drivers, however, is holding up the operation.
You could always argue that more aid needs to get there, but I can tell you with certainty that even if today we were able to deliver to Puerto Rico a historic amount of aid in a short period of time, our ability to get that aid from San Juan to any other place on the islands or on the island or some of the smaller islands is significantly diminished, if not non-existent. The supply chain, the logistical chain in Puerto Rico is broken. It's not just broken, it is shattered. It is non-existent at this point.
President Trump is slated to visit Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands next Tuesday, but he has been roundly criticized for the slowness of Washington's response to the island's plight. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. says a coalition strike has killed 3 Islamic State drone experts in Syria. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson heads to China amid North Korea nuclear concerns. A poll finds 4 in 5 Americans feel dreamers should stay in the U.S. and become citizens. And a new study finds weather extremes and fossil fuel pollution is costing the U.S. $240 billion. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. New revelations about Russian involvement in the U.S. presidential election continue to be revealed. Twitter told the House and Senate Intelligence Committees Thursday that it had shut down more than 200 accounts after determining they were linked to Russia's efforts to interfere in U.S. politics. The closed-door sessions followed similar briefings earlier this month with Facebook, which has also agreed to provide lawmakers with 3,000 Russia-linked ads involving divisive social and political issues that were placed on its platform. The committees are examining the spread of false news stories and whether anyone in the United States aided in targeting content to certain users. In the case of Twitter, that includes examining so-called bot accounts that are set up to quickly and automatically spread information. And joining us now for more on all of it is attorney and political commentator James Goodnow. James, so with all that we're hearing about all these social media interference with Russia, there's nothing really we're learning, though, about the big investigation being conducted by special counsel Robert Mueller. What do you make of what's transpiring and the fact that we're really not hearing much from him at all? No smoking gun revelations, pretty much silence.
So I think this is potentially the most dangerous point of this investigation for Donald Trump. And I think that may be counterintuitive at first. You're right. We don't have the big revelation of a Comey firing, or we don't have the Trump Tower meeting where we have more and more Russian actors who continue to appear at this. So it seems in some ways that it's been more silent. But if you think about it from a legal perspective, from the perspective of a prosecutor, this is a critical moment. What we do know about what's happening is we have requests for production of documents that are being sent to the White House, and that's simply saying, give us everything you have on Russia. We also know that Bob Mueller right now is interviewing former and current senior staff members from the White House. And those staff members have an obligation to speak truthfully with Bob Mueller and his team. And if they don't, it's illegal. It doesn't matter that it's not under oath. It may not be perjury, but it is a crime to lie to a federal investigator. So what we're seeing now, based on what we can glean from the information that is coming out, is that Bob Mueller is putting together a strong case, as a good prosecutor would, that could end with indictments. Now, I think most people, when you think about, oh, what is a prosecutor's role and how do you secure an indictment, you think about those big bombshell revelations. But the truth is, that's what happens on TV. That's not what happens in reality. In reality, convictions are secured, indictments are successful when you have a slow, methodical approach, and brick by brick, you put the case together. And right now, based on what at least it appears, Bob Mueller is building that case.
What do you think he's investigating? Is it anti-corruption laws? Is it obstruction of justice? What do you think he's focused on, or is it multiple things?
Yes and yes. What's interesting about Mueller's investigation is it is multifaceted. And so I would try to analogize this to a python. What's happening now is you have Mueller and his team surrounding the president and all issues, and they're starting to constrict now. And certainly that's looking at the big issues like obstruction of justice and the Comey firing and related events. Yes, that's true. We also have this new added element about foreign money entering the campaign potentially through Facebook with these troll farms. And we know that Bob Mueller's team is working with the IRS in securing Paul Manafort's taxes. And so you see right now every angle Bob Mueller is coming in. So I think most people would imagine, well, it's going to be a firing squad and Mueller will just come in and mow them down. No, that's not the way it works. He's closing that vice right now in all directions on Donald Trump. Now, clearly, Mueller's investigation is zeroing in on Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn. And the reason for that is there are probably acts of malfeasance that have taken place that have been well discussed in the media. But it's also because these are flip points. And by that I mean, if you get enough damaging information on Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn, eventually they may want to talk and they may want to cut a deal. So it's a classic move of a prosecutor. So what's so dangerous for Donald Trump is not any one category. Mm. It's the fact that Mueller is attacking on all fronts. Mm. And it will be very difficult for Trump to change the narrative or move away or pivot when you have Mueller coming at you in a thousand different directions.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective, attorney and political commentator James Goodnow. And joining us now is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Andrew, I imagine we're not talking about food today, are we?
I wish. I wish. That would be a nice change of pace. But no, we are talking about the same things that we talk about just about every day, because they are always at the top of the news, and starting with President Trump and social media. Mm, of course, we talked about yesterday that President Trump said that Facebook was colluding with the mainstream media to be anti-Trump. Mm-hmm. And after he made that statement, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg went to Facebook, of course, to set the record straight. And he put out a very lengthy Facebook post where he says that Trump says Facebook is against him. Liberals say that we help Trump. Both sides are upset about ideas and content they don't like. That's what running a platform for all ideas looks like. Hmm. And then he goes on to say the facts suggest that the greatest role Facebook played in the 2016 election was different from what most are saying. And he goes on to tout ways that Facebook had a positive impact in the 2016 election. Billions of interactions discussing issues. Every candidate in the primaries, there must have been at least 24 of them, had a Facebook page. Number of people up to 2 million that registered to vote through Facebook. So he said that these are all the positives. We shouldn't focus on the negatives. We should look at all the actual things that Facebook helped to do. He said that after the election, he made a comment that he thought misinformation on Facebook was a crazy idea. Calling it crazy, he says, was dismissive, and I regret it. This is too important an issue to be dismissive. So he does recognize that there is an importance to these claims. Okay. He's just trying to set the record straight.
Okay.
Whether it actually does or not remains to be seen.
Interesting. Okay, well, that's a good start, I guess. Maybe late, but...
Better late than never.
Better late than never, for sure. Anything else going on?
Well, we've got to give some love to the other big social network out there, of course, Twitter. Twitter's Vice President of Policy, Colin Corwell, testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee on Thursday in a closed-door session to figure out the extent of the Russian interference on Twitter, because it's not just Facebook that was involved with this, it was Twitter as well. Now, that hearing comes amid reports that Russian groups are not just using Twitter to influence the election, they are actually using it, allegedly, to influence the debate over the National Football League players that are kneeling during the national anthem. There have been reports that some of the tweets that have come out about whether players should kneel or stand have come from Russian-linked accounts. This is something that I'm sure that came up in that hearing on Thursday, and I'm sure it's going to come up on November 1st, because November 1st is the day that the Senate Intelligence Committee has announced they're calling Facebook, Google, and Twitter to testify about all of this interference. So mark your calendars. November 1st is going to be a big day on Capitol Hill and some big headlines about those social media companies.
I understand you have something a little on the lighter side, too.
Yeah, we talk about all this heavy news, so let's end with a fun story for once. Late night host Stephen Colbert had comedian Nick Kroll on his show this week.
Okay.
And they agreed, while they were chatting on the show, every time a celebrity puts up an awkward photo from their childhood on social media, Colbert and Kroll are going to donate money to relief efforts in Puerto Rico after Hurricanes Irma and Maria. So they started it off. They put up pictures of themselves, awkward pictures from their childhood, and used the hashtag PuberMe, like puberty, but PuberMe. Dozens of celebrities have joined in now. We're getting some levity seeing these pictures of them in their awkward
years
with braces and bad hair. But it's all for a good cause because it's raising money for the relief efforts in Puerto Rico. So one instance where social media is being used to have some fun, but also for a good cause.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. We appreciate it. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, an Australian-based Saudi women's rights activist who escaped a public lashing for driving in Saudi Arabia has vowed to return to her native country and become one of the first to legally get behind the wheel following Tuesday's royal decree by King Salman. The kingdom, the birthplace of Islam, has long been criticized as the only country that barred women drivers. Now, the order is set to be fully implemented by June 24th of next year. It is one piece of a set of reforms called Vision 2030, put in motion by the king, who took over in 2015, and his son, 32-year-old Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Some women have been engaged in decades of struggle to gain the right to drive, including Manal al-Sharif, who took part in the Women to Drive protest movement. She spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty.
I was in tears. I couldn't believe it. It took 27 years from the first protest.
What will it mean for women?
I don't think anything will emancipate women in my country more than driving their own car. I know it sounds ridiculous and it sounds mundane act, everyday act in other countries, but it's not the case in Saudi Arabia. I've been fighting for this right for a long time, and we've been deprived from a basic right, the last country on earth that allowed women to drive. And women been losing a lot to be full citizens and participate fully in the economical growth of the country because of this simple basic human right of mobility that had been stripped away from them. So it means a lot. Saudi Arabia will never be the same after this historical day, I call it.
But will it improve economic opportunities, perhaps more jobs for women?
Exactly. We're 11% of the workforce, and that tells you something. Not only because the jobs women were being deprived from because they were women, they're not allowed to work with men. Not because only of that, even the woman-only job, they've been deprived from because they couldn't find a mean of transportation to her job.
What prompted the king to issue this royal decree? Was it the protest movement? Was it a reform effort? What was it?
Believe me, Saudi Arabia is the country that you don't expect anything. You don't understand how things are happening in Saudi Arabia. Living in an absolute monarchy, these are things that you don't expect them. But I think there are so many factors that led to this, personally, believing. Many factors. First of all, there has been so much pressure from the international media and the international community in Saudi Arabia. We've been known as the last country on earth where women don't drive. Anywhere you go, the officials always been asked and pressured when women are going to be allowed to drive. And I can tell you just from the fact that I've been swamped with emails and phone calls and messages for interviews because of this decree. That tells you how much there is pressure on Saudi Arabia to just end this long-standing ban. Plus, the vision of 2030 that wants to empower women and raise the percentage of women in the workforce to 30%. You cannot do that, and women are at the backseat, and they're not allowed to drive.
All right. Well, among the economic consequences, male drivers from many other countries could face unemployment. But that will ease the financial burden on Saudi families, boost car sales, and the need for auto insurance. In a further sign of change, a Saudi woman has been named to a senior government post. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, Hugh Hefner, the publisher of Playboy magazine, died at the age of 91 this week. Famous for his smoking jacket, his magazine, and his lifestyle, Hefner single-handedly changed the publishing industry and maybe the world. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
This year's PMOY is a winner in every way. She is Raquel Pomplin.
For nearly 60 years, there have been Playmates of the Year. It was a much different world back in 1950, when Hugh Hefner published the first Playboy magazine.
Well, I remember, with great fondness, the very beginnings of it all. You know, the days in which I held the first issue of the magazine, realized that I was going to be in the business for a while. Because I started the magazine in 1950 with no money, literally. With just enough money borrowed and investments by a few friends and relatives to produce just one issue.
From those humble beginnings, an empire was born. Playboy was the most popular men's magazine for nearly four decades, and it made Hefner not only rich, but famous. Famous enough to get his own Hollywood star.
The fact that it would be so successful and that it would not only succeed, but also would become such a phenomenon and would, in the 60s, literally change the world. Who could possibly imagine that?
At the height of its popularity, the magazine boasted nearly 7 million subscribers. Hefner expanded his empire into brick-and-mortar Playboy clubs around the country. The last one closed in 1988. He also expanded his influence overseas and altered the international editions of his magazine to suit the morals of each region.
I mean, there's no nudity in the Indonesian edition, but it's a lifestyle magazine. One of the things that I have always felt about Playboy, whether it included the centerfolds or not, is that the magazine, you know, it's not a sex magazine. If it had been, it would not be as continually as popular as it is today.
His savvy and his ability to embody the lifestyle inside the pages of his magazine made Hefner a larger-than-life figure, but he insists his success was simply a matter of doing what he wanted to do.
Follow your own dreams. I think that the secret to a good life is when you're young, if you're a dreamer, you dream impossible dreams, and there are a lot of pressures to conform and change, etc. I think that a best life is one where one pursues one's own personal dreams.
Hugh Hefner, dead at 91. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Well, Hugh Hefner, of course, will be remembered. There are few new movies in U.S. theaters, and here to talk about them is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. So, Jeff, let's start with Battle of the Sexes. This is a story of that 1973 tennis match between world number one Billie Jean King, played by Emma Stone in the movie, and ex-champ Bobby Riggs, played by Steve Carell. Now, this apparently became the most watched television sports event of all time and billed as the Battle of the Sexes, right?
Well, you know, I'm Generation X, so I was maybe 7 years old, but I do remember seeing the ads for this and the Battle of the Sexes, and I remember Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs, because, you know, they were celebrities that were on every talk show and everything. And back then, we had three channels to choose from, so if you couldn't escape watching ABC and seeing this match of the century being promoted. It's all about women's liberation, about equal rights, about pay, about everything. This is where it all started in the modern times with Billie Jean King and the sports world of tennis. Because they were not getting the same pay as the male counterparts were getting.
It says here that you're offering the men's winner $12,000 and $1,500 to the women's.
Those are the terms.
The men's prize needs to be that high to attract the best players. We're trying to make this the most prestigious tournament in America.
And paying the women less than ever makes it more prestigious.
It's just simply a question of what we can afford.
People pay to see the men.
So these guys were making all this money in their championship games, and the women were making not even close to what they were doing. So Billie Jean King led the way, saying, we're leaving this organization, we're starting our own. And she was doing really well at it. But, of course, they were broke. They were going town to town and all these tournaments. And Bobby Riggs, you know, he was popular. He was famous. But he didn't get his time in the sun, you know, his spotlight. So he was playing up the male chauvinist pig, as the phrase was back then. And he was challenging her to say, look, who's better at tennis, men or women? And just kept getting more and more outrageous, being the first kind of media social star, you know, of the time. And so this thing just got bigger and bigger and bigger. So when you're watching the movie, it just captures 1973 so well. I mean, I thought I was back in my childhood watching this movie. And not only that, Steve Carell is hysterical as Bobby Riggs, and also Emma Stone plays Billie Jean King perfectly. And not only do we see how the world of tennis was evolving and how women were evolving in the workplace and about how they were demanding equal treatment and equal pay and all of these things, but also it touches on her personal life, you know, exploring her sexuality. So that's a little part of the film, too. So this is from the directors of Little Miss Sunshine. I think it's engaging, it's fun, it's educational. Billie Jean King's been doing publicity around for the movie, and she's saying, look, you know, this is inspired by some events. A lot of this happened. It's not a documentary, you know, mm-hmm. It's for entertainment.
Right.
But overall, a lot of it's true, but a lot of it's, you know, of course, embellished and dramatic license. But Emma Stone and the cast and Steve Carell, this is a great film. It really is.
Awesome. Okay. Well, what about the new Tom Cruise movie? Another thriller, lots of action, I assume.
It is, but all for the different reasons this time. It's called American Made, and it's based on the true story of Barry Seal, who was a TWA pilot back in the late 70s and the early 80s, and he was recruited by the CIA to run guns to the Contras. So you remember back Reagan and administration in the 80s were worried that communism was spreading to Central America, and so they found him, Barry Seal, and said, look, start running guns for us, and, you know, we'll give you a cover, we'll do all these exciting things, we'll pay you. But at the same time, Pablo Escobar was coming to power. He found out what was going on, landing in Colombia and all these different countries. You're going to start running cocaine for us, since, you know, all the airways of where all the government and all the feds are watching, you can circumnavigate that, drop the cocaine, and we'll pay you, you know, $100,000 per kilo.
Top of your class in the Civil Air Patrol, a pilot like you shouldn't be flying buses.
Welcome to Miami.
Welcome to Bakersfield.
Haven't you ever wanted something more, Barry? You should be serving your country.
Your CIA.
So the movie shows him not only running guns, but also running drugs. He's playing both sides. He's getting so much money, tens of millions of dollars in cash, he can't even store it anywhere. So it's just outrageous to see that the Medellin, Colombia cartel, they shot all these scenes in Colombia and also in Molina, Texas. What I love about this movie is Tom Cruise is not fighting aliens. He's not fighting mummies. He's playing a normal, regular guy. And I think this is one of his best roles because he's so charming. He's a family man. But this is what happens when it's just a lonely pilot all of a sudden becomes so wealthy and things get so complicated, you can't believe what you're watching actually happen.
Wow, sounds like a pretty big endorsement there.
Yeah, it's like the Wolf of Wall Street when you watch this kid start from nothing, you know, selling penny stocks, being this incredibly rich, successful guy, but then it all falls apart. They all get caught sooner or later, and I think it's one of Tom Cruise's best roles, and it's a great film.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard. Find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com.
I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Patrick Dia. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Under President Trump, the United States of America is firmly committed to the cause of human rights because we are committed to keeping the peace, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence recently told the U.N. Security Council. Vice President Pence's words highlighted a call for needed reforms in the United Nations Human Rights Council, or UNHRC. The United Nations, he said, is bound by its charter to foster international cooperation in promoting and encouraging respect for human rights and for fundamental freedoms for all.
As we look at the membership of the Council today, we see nations that betray these timeless principles upon which this institution was founded. Today, the United Nations Human Rights Council actually attracts and welcomes many of the worst human rights violators in the world.
Vice President Pence noted that Cuba sits on the council despite its record of repression. Another member, Venezuela, undermines democracy and imprisons political opponents to its regime. Vice President Pence also called for reform of the UN Human Rights Council agenda item on Israel, recalling that it is the only country with an agenda item dedicated to it. In addition to his call for reform of the Human Rights Council, Vice President Pence asked the United Nations Security Council and all nations to call out human rights abuses with action, courage, and conviction. In particular, he called on the security forces of Myanmar to stop the persecution of the Rohingya Muslim people that has driven them from their homes in the hundreds of thousands. He called on the UN Security Council to act swiftly to bring the crisis to an end. Through reform of our efforts and reform of this institution, through renewed courage to speak and act whenever and wherever the unalienable rights of innocent people or the peace of the world is at risk, said Vice President Pence, we will create, as our president said, a more safe and peaceful future for all mankind.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.